And today we've got, I think, a very, very topical discussion on sort of disability, the Paralympics, and what sort of legacy, if any, it has left behind. I think the focus on disability is relevant because, one, we've had the past month or so of the Paralympics and related discussion around that. It's also a time when there's a great focus on welfare cuts. Disabled people will more than likely face the brunt of that. There's even an added sort of moral sin censorship around some aspects of disability. If you think about the furore over Frankie Boyle and his jokes and the sort of Twitter storm that ensued after that, and a sort of feeling that you can't say the sort of things that Frankie Boyle said. So it's certainly a very relevant topic, and we've got three esteemed discussants here who I'll introduce in a bit. They're each going to speak for about 7 or 8 minutes each, and then we'll throw it open to the floor for questions and or comment. Okay, now I'll introduce the speakers in the order they're going to speak. To my left is Dave Clements. Dave is a writer in social policy and a former public servant with 13 years' experience working in local government, predominantly social care. He now works as a consultant in the public, voluntary and community sectors, and he manages Neighbourhoods Connect, a flagship social media and community development project in Haringey. Do you call it flagship? Is that your word?
That was my word.
Yeah. Dave is also a co-author of The Future of Community, Reports of a Death Greatly Exaggerated, which came out in 2008. He's a convener of the Institute of Ideas Social Policy Forum and a member of the Battle of Ideas Organising Committee. He writes for various publications, including The Guardian's Joe Public blog and the online magazine Spite. And he also has his own blog called Reflecting on a Big Society.
Reflections on a Big Society.
That keeps on getting smaller, something like that.
I wrote it a while ago.
To my immediate right is Dr. Catherine Brunswick-Cole. She's Research Fellow in Disability Studies and Psychology in the Research Institute for Health and Social Change at Manchester Metropolitan University. Catherine's research focuses on the lives of disabled children, young people and their families. She's published extensively in publications for academics, practitioners, parents and carers. She's the mother of a disabled child and advocates for disability rights. The final speaker on the right is Dennis Joe. Dennis is a poet and freelance writer in Liverpool. He teaches poetry for the Liverpool charity North End Writers, as well as co-editing their journal, The Accent. He's a supporting member of the Spider Project and edits the client magazine, Ceros for Nugent Care. His blog, Talking Verse, was set up early in January 2011 as a forum to discuss issues around poetry. And although you wouldn't know it from that, I also know that he is very clued up around disability issues. So the first speaker, Dave Clements.
Thank you. I'll start with the Paralympics. Baron Pierre de Coubertin, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, the founder of the modern games, is associated with two notions of what the Olympics, and by extension the Paralympics, is all about. First we have Citius Altius Fortius, again hopefully I've pronounced that correctly, or swifter, higher, stronger. And then there is, and I paraphrase, well, they're only the games, aren't they? So it's about taking part, and it's not really about winning. So those are the two kind of notions of what the Olympics are about. So on the face of it, they're contradictory notions. But the metaphor of the level playing field, I think, perhaps is the most relevant when we're talking about the politics of disability. That used to be the objective of chaining your wheelchair to the railings, as far as I was concerned. You wanted to achieve a level playing field. Now, Oscar Pistorius upset a few assumptions about level playing fields with his carbon fibre blades, judged to be an advantage by critics at the Olympics. I was at the Paralympics to see a slightly pissed off, if you can say that here, Pistorius, lose to the taller-bladed Alan Oliveira in the 200 metres final. While no longer invincible, he had prompted many of us, I think, to conclude that the supposed heroism of Paralympians needn't be of the kind of patronising overcoming bad stuff that happened in the past variety. Beyond the backstories of personal adversity, prosthetic limbs had come a long way, and disability needn't necessarily be as disabling as it once was. One might even have a competitive advantage as a consequence of having a disability, and being abled with a little technological doping, as I believe it's called, and a lot of training, to perform better than so-called able-bodied athletes. The president of the International Olympic Committee asked that the word disability not be used during the Games. He said, you know what the word disabled means? It means something doesn't work. It doesn't function. How would you like to be called that? Now, I think he was wrong to try to tell us what words we can and can't use, but I think he was right to question what we mean by disability today. While most of us were getting excited about the Games and selling out the 2.5 million available tickets, others were getting worked up into a bit of a frenzy about the sponsorship issue. For campaigners, Atos, contracted by the Department for Work and Pensions to carry out the hated work capability assessments, became the Paralympic equivalent of Coca-Cola and Cadbury, who sponsored the Olympics. Cameron doesn't give a toss about people with disabilities, they quipped hysterically. They called for a boycott of the evil multinational that had recently pledged to invest $100 million in international Paralympic sports over the next 10 years. Disabled People Against the Cuts joined forces with UK Uncut and scuffled with police outside the DWP offices and the Atos offices as well. Also, the Team GB athletes allegedly hid their Atos emblazoned lanyards at the opening ceremony. Far from inspiring a generation, one commentator objected that the sermon in form-fitting lycra was being exploited to make disabled people feel inadequate and guilty, guiltily dependent on the hard-working taxpayer. According to Ade Adepitan, who's a basketball medalist in the Paralympics from a few years back, and also the co-presenter with Claire Balding of the Channel 4 coverage, he said, without DLA, which is Disability Living Allowance, I would not have been able to do what I did or be a top athlete. So DLA is a non-means-tested benefit, for those of you who don't know, used to pay for transport, equipment, care needs, etc. And it's clearly relied on by a large number of people, including Paralympians. Former Paralympian Tanny Gray Thompson explains that disabled people face typically higher living costs as a result of their impairment. Still, 3.2 million people, and that's a lot of people, more than the 2.5 million who attended the Paralympics, are on DLA at a cost of £12.6 billion a year. The infamously tighter and probably unfair new assessment criteria and testing regime are designed to get 500,000 people off DLA over the next 4 years as the benefit is phased out. Now, I don't doubt that there's more than a little substance in what one campaigner described as the horror stories around DLA, but the welfare system, I believe, does need reforming. And more importantly, I think our welfare culture needs challenging. It should support people with disabilities to lead active lives as far as possible. And the possible being something that is a category that's been extended. And I think we've seen that at the Olympics. I think it should be much more enabling rather than disabling in the sense that it actually doesn't necessarily help disabled people unproblematically, but can actually lead to a certain amount of dependency, independent of a person's disability. So I think what we have from the critics of welfare reform is a diminished and dependent view of what people with disabilities are capable of. So Polly Toynbee, she said, celebrate the Paralympians, but remember what they say they need from the state to get them there. So rather insultingly, she seeks to place the welfare state on the podium rather than the athletes themselves. Echoing Toynbee, a disability rights activist claims that their astonishing achievements would not have been possible without a state striving for inclusion, integration and equality. So not only would I say it's reasonable to question why so many people are claiming this benefit and whether their money might be better, well, whether our money, rather, would be better spent on reducing people's dependency. Rather than doing that, I think we need to challenge the belittling and state-enamoured assumptions that's held by those who think they're speaking on behalf of people with disabilities. I think the relentless portrayal of the disabled in the most unflattering of terms as weak, vulnerable, state-dependent creatures is hardly conducive to a struggle for something better. Never mind throw a javelin, they seem to say, they can barely leave the house. But the hardest hit, there's even a campaign called The Hardest Hit, intent on winning only in the sport of competitive victimhood, I think. Which is all rather, I think, because the one thing the campaigners go on about endlessly is how badly disabled people are portrayed and how prejudiced the able-bodied are. The games are an opportunity to educate the plebs into treating disabled people better. That seems to be the general approach. Indeed, you'd be mistaken for thinking that the only reason for holding a Paralympics is to educate the able-bodied. I think this is perhaps the Paralympic legacy. Bugger the sport seems to be the message. We've got more important things to lecture on. And that was the premise of much of the contemporary, much of the commentary rather, both before and during the Games. Jackie Ashley at The Guardian thought the Paralympics may be morally more important than the Olympics. Pistorius, again in a rather backhanded compliment, declared that the UK public are far more educated and therefore, presumably, well suited to lecturing the rest of the world. The Games can do quite a lot to change people's perceptions, he said. So critics argue that the government, with its welfare reforms, are making things worse by portraying the disabled as strangers. Not only that, they claim that a duped and prejudiced public are going along with it. So the not very funny comedian Jeremy Hardy joined the anti-ATOS protesters and had this to say. It's just so cynical, because that strategy has been targeted at people who don't have much, trying to make them hate people who have less, which I think in itself is quite a cynical analysis. Philippa Perry, a psychotherapist and wife of transvestite artist Grayson Perry, claimed that the disabled people experience hate, guilt, patronising attitudes, avoidance and persecution. Last year we had the Twitter storm over Ricky Gervais' use of the word mong. This year we had Frankie Boyle, who actually I don't think was particularly offensive. He said, it's got to be weird being a Paralympian under this government, knowing that a medal means you'll lose your disability living allowance. Unless jokes about the benefit system aren't allowed anymore. Both Gervais and Boyle pricked, I think, the thin-skinned culture of offence-taking rather than feeding off any wider hatefulness toward people with disabilities. Menkat felt moved, nevertheless, to tell Channel 4 to ban Boyle from causing profound offence to disabled people. George Galloway, again on Twitter, caused offence by calling somebody a window licker, a derogatory term for people with disabilities, one I confess I hadn't heard of. Until the comment was retweeted, and then Mencap, again, were deeply offended and declared that hate crime and bullying are a daily reality for many disabled people, and the use of language like this only furthers hostility and violence. But I'd question whether this is really the case. It's repeated so often you'd think it was an uncontestable fact, but one recent Guardian headline, for instance, screamed, "Disability hate crime is at its highest level since records began." So reportedly, there were 1,788 recorded incidents, far fewer convictions, I might add, in England and Wales in 2011, representing an increase of 18% on the previous year, which incidentally is when records began. So you know, I think this is a category that was not entirely legitimate. So who's disabling who here, just to conclude? Maybe they have ulterior motives, but I would argue that it's ironic that it's the reforming political class rather than campaigners themselves who seem to believe most in what people with disabilities are able to do. Far from defending the welfare status quo, I think those who really want to improve things should be asking some challenging questions about the welfare system, much as they are, I think, in regard to REMPLOY and the shockingly poor and sometimes abusive care standards that learning disabled people experience in care homes. I think the failure of compassion levelled at ATOS and the DWP may well spring from the same managerial culture. So I'm not arguing that the state should no longer support people with disabilities. But I do believe it can do a better job, and that campaigners should stop portraying disabled people as helpless victims who are forever dependent on handouts.
Okay, thank you, Dave. Plenty to think about there. We can give them all a clap at the end of three. Over to Catherine.
Okay, I wanted to start with the title of the discussion, Disabled by Society, Enabled by the Legacy, and take both parts separately. So I'm going to start by asking, are disabled people disabled by society? And then by asking, will disabled people be enabled by the legacy? And my position in brief is to answer yes to the first question and no to the second. So in the time I have, I want to set out the reasons for my responses and conclude by suggesting some ways forward. So first, what does it mean to say that disabled people are disabled by society. We know that everyday understandings of disability suggest that disability is caused by a bodily problem, so a missing limb, a missing chromosome. However, over the last 30 years, the disabled people's movement has challenged this understanding of disability and suggested instead that people with impairments, missing limbs, chromosomes and so on, are disabled not by the presence of their impairment, but by society's attitudes to them. They argue that disability is a form of social oppression, similar to racism and sexism. They claim that by removing the barriers to disabled people's participation, so providing ramps or sign language, interpretation, communication aids and so on, that disability as social oppression could be eliminated. Now, there have been many nuanced and complex arguments about the social model of disability, as it is known. But this approach has been crucial to promoting disability rights in the UK, and it underpins much of the equality legislation we have. So my position is that people with impairments are still disabled by society in many and complex ways. So to evidence this point, I want to turn first to a few hard facts about the lives of disabled people in the UK today. 4 in 10 disabled children live in poverty. Only 16% of mothers of disabled children work. That compares to 61% of mothers of non-disabled children. Children with special educational needs and disability are 9 times more likely to be excluded from school than their non-disabled peers. Only 40% of disabled men and women are in work, compared with 80% of non-disabled women and 90% of non-disabled men. And last year, Inclusion London found that the number of media outputs representing disabled people in negative ways, so as benefit scroungers, for example, has risen sharply. And I have some different hate crime figures from The Guardian for you. My figures are that disability hate crime is rising, and that in 2011, 2,095 hate crimes were reported against the previous year of 1,559. We can argue about that later. MenCap tell us that 90% of people with learning difficulties have experienced hate crime. And it's this violence against disabled people that I want to focus on for a moment. As part of a 2-year research project funded by the Economic and Social Research Council, I have to say that because they gave us the money to do the research, we talked to families with disabled children and disabled children, and we found numerous examples of violence against disabled children. A mother told us about her daughter being bullied on a bus and having tampons shoved in her mouth. See, this is the page, it doesn't open. We saw posts from trolls writing offensive messages on websites for parents of disabled children. There's a website called Every Disabled Child Matters, and so somebody had actually taken time to join a Facebook page and then write offensive comments on that site. Disabled families told us that they were asked not to bring their disabled children to family weddings. In schools, disabled children were kept in separate parts of the playground, away from their non-disabled peers. And under pressure and marketised cultures, schools continue to operate in ways that systematically exclude disabled children and young people. Most of all, families told us about their day-to-day encounters with strangers who stared at or commented on their disabled children and even cruelly pulled their own children away if they got too close to a disabled child. So yes, it's clear to me that people with impairments are still disabled by society. So will disabled people be enabled by the Paralympic legacy? Well, I have to admit that some good things have come out of the Paralympics. I'm not sure David's going to agree with me, but the best bit for me was George Osborne being booed. And I'm glad that more people will be aware that David Cameron doesn't give a toss, and they'll be aware of the company Atos and the role it plays in the unfair and unjust work capability assessment process. And there is now a recognition that disabled people who want to be can be elite athletes. But in terms of the legacy, it seems to me that the Paralympics will do little to end the violence towards disabled people I outlined above. And I think there are several reasons for this. First is that the coverage of the Paralympics was dominated by a triumph over tragedy commentary. Paralympians are superhuman. That was the Channel 4 tag for the Paralympics over here. The disabled activist and artist Liz Carr has called this inspiration porn, where non-disabled people get off on seeing disabled people overcome their impairments. So linked to this, there's been a celebration of hypernormality and the achievement of the individual. There's been a troubling fascination with and fetishization of, and I said that word, hooray, the disabled body in the coverage of the Paralympics. And sadly, particularly sadly to me, people with learning difficulties have been almost invisible during the Paralympics. And as Ian Birrell said in The Guardian last week, our society has a confused attitude to learning disabilities, which are all too often swept under the carpet. It's hard to construct a heroic struggle against the odds for people with learning difficulties. There are no obvious role models, no Stephen Hawking, no Oscar Pistorius, and no Stevie Wonder. No high-functioning people with profound learning difficulties made companions of honour, winning Paralympic medals or being hailed as musical geniuses. Another particularly sinister outcome of the Paralympics is the way that they've been used as a weapon against disabled people in the campaign for benefit reform. Showing that disabled people can achieve, they are not wimps or victims, and so the argument goes, government can and should cut their benefits. So as the golden summer of sport comes to an end, disabled people will be sorted and divided into the deserving and the undeserving, those who have triumphed over tragedy and those who have not, the superhumans and the benefit scroungers. And that may well be the Paralympic legacy. Or perhaps we could focus on a different narrative within the Paralympic story. Let's focus on what the athletes told us, and I'm talking about the athletes from the Paralympics and the Olympics, about how they achieved their success. Their speeches acknowledging their coaches, their families, their partners, and in some cases their disability benefits. We none of us achieve in isolation. We none of us achieve without support. And for some people, that support takes the form of benefits and care services. So rather than spending our time sorting disabled people into superhumans and benefits scroungers, we need to recognise and celebrate diversity and interdependence, not independence, in all our lives. And perhaps that could be the Paralympic legacy.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Final speaker, Dennis, over to you.
Thanks very much. I think my main thing about disability is the actual use of the term which Dave alluded to. I wonder actually whether it's actually the right term to be using. Apart from the Paralympics and the recent changes that the government are putting forward in benefits, another event took place in Liverpool recently. It was the Dada Fest, the Disabled and Deaf Arts Fest. And it was quite interesting because in the arts movement, the disabled arts movement, there is a little bit of bad feeling from those that we would call physically disabled to those that are classed as having learning difficulties and such like. And very much this was reflected in the Dada exhibition itself at Blue Coat, because a lot of the exhibits were actually to do with medicines and such like, rather than to do with which you would normally have. There was one or two which were of disabled people, models of disabled people and able-bodied people. But mainly it was about the mental health issues and such like. And I was reading through Scope's report on the rise in violence or aggression against disabled people. In one sense, it didn't actually surprise me. It didn't surprise me because there are now the actual terminology of disabled has grown to such an extent as to actually be almost meaningless. What do we mean by disabled? We're including people with some people, alcoholics and addicts get classed as disabled. People with learning difficulties, the actual term learning difficulties itself is quite widespread. But one interesting thing that I did notice in I attended one of the discussions at the Dada Fest, There's a discussion where three artists from South Africa were brought over, and a British artist had organised this. And it's quite interesting because three artists were HIV positive, and they showed a film with the three artists in there talking about what they were doing, getting on with their lives. One had set up a business, another one had become a successful artist, another one was becoming a central figure in her church and such like. Then what amazed me, which I couldn't believe, was the fact that they talked about their lives and the positive roles they were playing in their society. And then this white artist from Britain comes along and tells them they're disabled. And all of a sudden, they are classed as disabled. I also think that I think the term is just being used much too widely. And so therefore, this idea, as it says in Scope, about the Scope report about people being seen as scroungers and whatever, I don't know, it's probably... Sometimes we can take these things with a pinch of salt. But even so, if it is true, then I'm not really surprised. Because how can we see so many people who... It's not fraudulence. We've seen the extension of the idea of incapacity and disability so much. And ironically, this actually began under Thatcher. When... in this country, when... that the unemployment figures had hit 3 million, and this was mass unemployment, and there was orders in the HSS, get the figures down. And I remember I was unemployed at the time and being asked by somebody at the department, do you have any illnesses? Get on income. And literally, hundreds of thousands of people moved from dole to incapacity benefit. And it sort of stayed like that. I mean, it became... the incapacity, it became a vicious circle, it just kept reading itself. So I wonder whether we really should be sort of like so negative about actually what ASOS are doing. You know, I accept the fact that this is a big undertaking, they're changing the benefits. I don't actually accept that it's cuts. I see it as changes rather than cuts. There's been no actual, if they're cutting anything, cutting the amount of people that will be claiming benefits. But, I mean, the actual making life difficult for the disabled people, I don't know. But I think it's a massive undertaking that they're doing, and, you know, there will be, there is a lot of mistakes being made, and there are a lot of appeals being won at the moment. But I think that, in one sense, what we have here is we have a sort of thing, where we, excuse me a minute. We have a situation where we actually don't even really know what disability is. And I think it's probably one of the things, if we're going to use that term, we should actually be precise about what it is. There are people who have difficulty getting out. DLA, for example, recognises the fact that people with disabilities have difficulty in travelling and such like, and therefore there is a need for more expense. That is why it's a non-means tested benefit, because it recognises that disabled people need more support and financial support as well. But I have to ask myself, has the actual approach, the changes to how we view disability, and which to me seem a conflict with, there's an elite which have a definition of disability, and then there's the rest of us who seem to be in conflict with what that is. And I wonder if it might not be important that we actually take a close look and actually look at this thing of the benefits changes that are coming around. Actually seeing that they actually raise important questions, and the important questions are, in short I suppose, are there too many disabled people in the world, and how far that term has been extended. Again, just quickly on the Paralympics thing and such, I mean, one legacy of Paralympics I think did show that, and hasn't really been mentioned, is the technology, medical technology and such like, is enabling millions of people around the world disabled people around the world to live a productive and active life on par with all able-bodied people, which is a hell of a lot different than what it was 30 or 40 years ago. It also strikes me as odd that the campaign that is going on at the moment against the government's cuts highlights this sort of idea that, like, oh, once upon a time, disabled people were kept out of things and they're kept out of society, you didn't see them, and what have you. And yet, there's a part of me which cynically views what the campaign is saying. And it seems to me that they want people to be on welfare benefits. In short, it seems to me that they're actually saying, actually, you know, disabled people can't play an active role in society. I think there is a lot of warped thinking. There's a lot of questions that need to be addressed on that. I think the one thing is about how we use the term disabled. I'll leave it there.
Okay, thank you. Can we have three speakers left? Just before I open up to questions and comments, now we'll take sort of three, four or five questions or comments at a time, just to give the speakers a rest, and let them gather their thoughts and give them time to think of really smart replies sort of back to you. If I could probably just take the opportunity to try and sort of recap, to make sense of my notes, some of the points that were being made, some very sort of interesting and sort of controversial sort of ones. And correct me if I'm summarising you wrong. Sort of, Dave, you mentioning sort of in some of the welfare reform debate, you get the feeling that the welfare reform's critics actually disparage disabled people far more than what the government is doing. That there's a moral agenda behind us as well, in the way that the elites see us masses as prejudiced people going about our business abusing disabled people on a daily basis, and a call for sort of censorship, which did make me sort of wonder, could you possibly, I'll just throw this open to the floor, could you argue that people like Frankie Boyle and Ricky Gervais are actually the construct of the censorious climate that we live in? Because they know if they say stuff like that, they're going to get a reaction. They know you're not supposed to say it, which is exactly why they say it. So you could say that they're actually the product of the censorious climate that we live in today. And Catherine was making some very good points here about the social model of disability and how there was a challenge to individual impairment, and had quite extensive statistics, which some of which I'm familiar with, to show how sort of disabled people are discriminated quite substantially in society in terms of unemployment and poverty and sort of stuff like that. Again, that sort of, although I don't doubt that for a minute, it's worth whether it, in some discussion about it, has things changed? Because I know when you look back at campaigns between psychiatric survivors, if you go back to the 70s and stuff like that, and similar with disabled activists, there was much more of an emphasis on the right to work. You know, if disabled people are more likely to be unemployed, isn't the answer for jobs rather than more benefits? But again, that's just me throwing something in. And I love the critiques of the Paralympics, the inspiration porn, and this focus on the achievement of the individual, you know, and sort of holding up these with something called super crips, you know, which totally ignores the reality of this, most disabled people's lives. And are we in danger of getting back to this deserving, undeserving debate? Dennis, asking, is disability the correct term? When terms get used so broadly, could argue that the term becomes meaningless. I sometimes find that when I look into what's classified as a mental health problem. Virtually everything, if everything's a mental health problem, you could argue then nothing is. So how do we define it? And it is very important. So for example, as I'm sure many of you are aware, there's many people in the deaf community with a capital D who do not accept that they're disabled at all, would see themselves as part of a cultural, linguistic minority. So it is quite a sort of relevant debate. And with my advancing years, I know that he's also right that the rise in disability figures, disabled people figures, was actually a ploy of the Thatcher government to reduce unemployment figures at that time. So I think they've got quite a lot to sort of try and tease out, put the speakers under pressure, not me, because I'm only the chair. So over to you. Feel free. Simon.
Catherine, you raised this issue about the levels of hate or the extent to which hate is expressed towards disabled people is on the rise. Now, I don't get that. My experience is that the involvement of disabled people in society is far greater and accepted than it ever was when I was growing up. So I don't quite understand what you're saying there. It doesn't ring true with my experience. And the ease with which you seem to move from hate crime to violence against disabled people, that was way too easy, that move, as though the two things are the same. So could you flesh out a little bit more what this definition of hate crime is?
Take a few at a time so you don't respond at the moment. Anyone else? Yeah?
Do you think, I mean, listening to all three, he's talking about the legacy of the Paralympics. Do you think it's actually given the public a skewed perception of what a disability actually is? And therefore, is it, you know, to me it sounds like it's segregated even further people with physical disability as opposed to those with a learning disability. And the public themselves actually only see people in the Paralympics with a physical disability as opposed to anything else. So do you think it's actually segregated even more?
Okay. Good question. Any others?
Going back to the just when there's the rise in the hate crime, for example, is that not just society in whole having rises in such crimes against any group in society, not necessarily disabilities?
Sure.
So society's getting hit.
Everybody's more, every group's more likely to,
to
suffer crime. Mm-hmm. Any others?
I don't understand why the extending the term disability to include people with different illnesses and impairments is problematic, unless it's imposed. If it's something that is being used as a tool to recognise this social disability in the way that Dr. Lunsford-Cole described, then surely is that not something that the example you gave, Dennis, was of artists with HIV. Is that not a useful thing to them? I understand what you're saying about the fact that the imposition of the label was a problem. But are you trying to say that there should be a line in the sand for the general use of the term? No, I don't think that it's necessary to have an explicit point at which, sorry, you're not allowed to use that word anymore.
So you're saying you can use it as an explicit tactic, as a progressive tactic for change?
I think that there shouldn't be a limit or a restriction to whether you call yourself disabled or not.
Okay, thanks.
And I think maybe I'm concerned about the extension.
Okay, thank you. At the back.
Oh, thank you so much. First of all, I'm visiting from Canada, and I don't know if this is interesting or ironic, but I'm here to participate in several disability studies conferences around the UK. So I'm just interested in this debate I'd like to make a couple comments. One, on Dennis, I hope I have the name right, Dennis's comment on the use and maybe even the extension of the term disability. It's difficult. Disabilities, like any other term, is used depending upon the purpose of the user. You know, so for example, let me give you some extensions of disability that I find kind of interesting and sort of offensive. Back in Toronto, Canada, where I live, we have streetcars. And often I hear on the radio in the mornings about there's a disabled streetcar on Queen Street. So I don't know if that streetcar is going to get benefits or nonetheless, there's some streetcars that are disabled now. Disabled vehicles, disabled trains on sports teams in Canada. If an athlete is injured and isn't able to play, they get on a disabled list. So they say he's on the DL or she's on the DL. Now, I think they still get the salaries, but nonetheless, there's that extension. I'm a blind person, so I'm blind and I get blindness extended too. Where sighted people often than I expect people with eyeballs to do, bump into each other. In train stations, particularly in Piccadilly, here, and they say, "What are you, blind?" and I'm just wondering if there's some sort of a test for that. So disability is the use is really, really extended. Depends upon its purpose. And one of the purposes we use, and I know this is true in Canada as well as I'm sure in the UK, is to put somebody down. Is to say something negative. And disability, I think, is more often used that way than almost in any other way. When we want to say something negative, we invoke disability. For example, I don't know, I haven't heard this much in the UK. I've only been here for about 10 days, so maybe I will. But I think I've heard it only a couple of times. Where someone will say, "How was your day?" And they say, "Oh, it was just crazy. It was nuts. Just insane." I think, okay, how many disability phrases are you going to use to put something down? Or sort to say something negative? So, that's one extension, Dennis. I'm not too crazy enough. Is that? Just a couple of other comments and then I'm going to stop. I mean, Catherine comment on, I think it was a comment on hate crimes, violence. I don't know the definition of hate crime here in the UK. I do know violence, though. And that comes in different kinds of forms. Not necessarily physical, but when I walk by somebody on the street, when I used to have a guide dog named Smokey, or now I have a white cane, and people do say this right in front of me, and I don't know, I haven't heard it yet in the UK, "There but for the grace of God, go I." Meaning, of course, their grace, but I'm not. You know. Now that's not exactly hate, or violent in the conventional way we have of thinking about those things. But I sure feel a little violent sometimes, you know. So I think there's that sort of thing. Now, insofar as this argument about who's disabled, is society disabling me, or is my blindness disabling me, or whatever the case may be, I do know that my society in Canada and here in the UK and other places I've been around the world, I do know that a large chunk of it was made for and by sighted people. And when I ask for a little thing on a lift that makes a ding when I know when the floors come about, so I know what floor I'm on, I get arguments like, "Well, that's pretty expensive." Yet, in the university I teach in Toronto, there are, I'm just guessing this, millions of dollars of lights installed for those of you who can see. Nobody questions the expense. Except me. See, you people have way too many lights. I cut down on that stuff. You know? Beautiful marble staircases sometimes have a bad experience. Those strike me as a little expensive. Well, those of you and those of us who walk, I am sure we don't need all that. In terms of benefits and daily living allowances, etc. You know, and again, I know more about the Canadian and American situation than it does UK, but the banks in America calling themselves like entrepreneuristic and capitalists, and getting some huge benefits from the government, way more than any single person would even dream of it. So I don't know why benefits and scroungers are restricted to those of us who are in the city.
Some excellent points there.
So, thank you.
Some excellent points, and also I think very good from social model of disability perspective, and how the sort of construction is aimed at certain groups of people, and how from another experience, it can be totally absurdly organised. Would you just like to come back?
I would, but he's left the room.
Oh, you want to come back on Simon?
To come on, yeah,
well,
back to Simon.
You'll have plenty of time to have a go at him. Does anyone else want to come
just
back?
Just before you go, given that those comments from Simon started out, and Simon's comments were based, he said, on his experience, it would be really good for me, at least, to know what that experience is. What's the basis?
We're waiting on you. The first response was going to be directed to you, and we also have...
Simon, you asked some questions and you refuted some of the arguments, in particular Catherine's arguments, on the basis of your experience. And I wondered, could you tell us what that experience is? Is it you walking around the street? Right, so, okay, there's nothing in particular about the experience that undercuts that, your reputations. Okay. It was just clarification.
So, Catherine, if you want to come back, you don't have to respond to everything. You want to come back in two or three, or all of them, if you so much.
I wanted to respond to the hate crime because it touches back to something that Dave said about, you said that only a very small number of people were convicted. Was this a real rise in hate crime? Was it a rise in reporting? That's the other thing that's been suggested. I don't think we can answer that question for sure, but my experience as the mother of a learning disabled child would tell me that that's probably right, that rise is real, that the reported hate crimes are probably a minuscule amount of the actual acts of hate crime that occur, that they're probably very underreported. I guess that the conviction rates have something to do with the perceived reliability of the witnesses or the victims of hate crime. I think it's a bit like the thing about rape. You know, not many rapes are convicted either. I don't think that it's a slippage in the way that you suggested to move from those mundane, everyday acts of violence. The things that Rod was talking about, those moments when you feel violated. In disability studies, people talk about psycho-emotional disabilism. So, for example, if because the ramp is at the back of the building, every day you go in the back of the building but your work colleagues go in the front of the building, that's another act of violation. It's an act of psycho-emotional disabilism which ratchets up and makes you feel that you're not as good as other people. Carol Thomas talks about it's what you can do but also who you can be. So I think there's a kind of continuum, and that this low-level abuse in the end manifests itself from winterborne view, where people have become completely dehumanized. They're not considered to be one of us. They're not considered to be normal people. And in a way that links to what Dennis was saying about the category of disability. The category of disability is always made in relation to the category of normal. And what's happened is that we never articulate what normal is, but by God, that category shrunk. So the expansion of the category of disability is actually a product of the shrinking of the category of normal. The other thing I wanted to say was, if I talk from my experience, I want to talk from experience for a moment, and the bullying that my son has experienced in school when he was surrounded by a group of boys in the toilets who got him, tried to get him to lick the toilet bowl. That's an act of violence and hate crime. And that is my one person experience. You know, I could tell you other stories of other friends, I could tell you other stories from research. And that it becomes almost mundane, it becomes almost every day. When you go into a restaurant and people stare at you, that happens to us every day. So my experience, I guess, is just very different from your experience. And I don't think there's a slippage. I think there's a continuum that ratchets up and ends somewhere not very good.
Can I just ask for clarification? Because I don't know. I'm not sure of it. How is hate crime defined? What makes a crime a hate crime?
I think it's on the basis of, because the person is disabled or because the person is black, if the crime is thought to, if it's an assault and the motivation for the assault was the presence of disability or the fact that the person was black, it's a hate crime, is my understanding.
And it can be verbal as well, it doesn't have to be physical, verbal.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, just on that, I think the whole hate crime discussion is interesting because I think we tend to have a discussion about what's going on now rather than placing the discussion in a historical context. I think anybody who's got even the vaguest notion of what disability meant 50 years ago, for instance, would surely accept that disabled people's part in society has completely changed. We don't have the kind of attitude that we would have had in the past. We don't ordinarily put disabled people away in arcane institutions and never see them again. We don't hide disabled people away. There isn't a shame about it. I think that's what the Paralympics showed, if anything. It showed that people were very enthusiastic about the Paralympics. People weren't making disparaging remarks about people running around the track. They were actually genuinely enthused and inspired by the whole thing. And I think the contrast between that and what disability campaigners are talking about is significant. I think when disability campaigners are the ones who are drawing attention to vulnerability and to the notion that disabled people are essentially victims, I think that kind of is problematic. It creates a situation where, far from encouraging us to identify with the person rather than the disability, it encourages us to over-identify with someone's victimised identity. And surely that's the complete opposite of where we should be going. So I think also anybody's experience is going to colour your view of disability. If you work in social care, if you have a personal experience of disability, that is going to colour your experience of the nature of disability and people's attitudes to it. As somebody who's worked in social care, as somebody who works with people with disabilities, I've tried to check my own reactions, because I think you can, if you work in child protection, for instance, you might get a very exaggerated notion of the scale of abuse. And I think the same goes for disability. I do think that attitudes have completely been transformed. And part of the problem, I would argue, is not that society is disabling, but rather that campaigners, through their approach, are actually having a disabling influence over the discussion and over the way we see people with disabilities.
Okay, thank you.
I think there is, from what Dave was saying, I think that's right. The thing about disability, I do find it problematical. It's the fact that the fact that it's used in such a wide way. It's actually part and parcel. I don't think it can be divorced from the whole cult of victimhood that we have today. There is a sort of, I started off in political campaigning about probably 30 years ago, and I remember the disabled movement at the time in the 70s and such like, and you know, they were not victims. Like, you know, they were crackheads with their crutches and such like. They demanded the right to work. They demanded access to places and that, everything. I mean, what they wanted to do was, they didn't want to be disabled. They wanted to live a parity with the rest of normal society. That seems to be very different today. And in fact, there seems to be more a thing to actually what you were saying about the denormalisation count. I think there is that sort of move to actually look down on normality. And it does concern me. I mean, over the years, I've seen people go from emphasising their strength, either in numbers or what they could do and such like, to actually emphasising their weaknesses. And I just really wonder, what is the point of that? If you're going to emphasise your weakness, you're going to sit down and go, oh, we're pathetic and what have you. Then if you really view the government as an enemy, then they're going to just have a great laugh and just walk all over you. Because you're already saying to them, we can't do anything. I think it is a change in terms. I think there's connected with that is also the way that there's a dehumanisation both of the disabled by this whole cult of victimhood, but there's also a dehumanisation of ordinary able-bodied people or abled people, in as much as look at what they're doing to us. Look how they're defining us. They're beating us up and they're doing this, that and the other. While I was reading through the report, a report that Scope did on hate crime, I mean, I don't go on with the term anyway, as a crime is something that's committed, not something, but that's neither here nor there for the moment. One of the things that occurred to me was that a lot of it was children. Now, I've got an older sister. I'm using the use of the term mentally handicapped. She doesn't have learning difficulties. She learned quite a lot. But we would have loads of kids coming out of school and she'd be out in front and they'd come along and they'd take the piss out of her and all that sort of thing. Me being the oldest brother, I'd have to go out and sort them out. But that's children. They're cruel. They're not socialised yet into normal social society as such. We should, you know, when we're actually comparing children to adults, there is something very, very wrong with the world we're living in. If we're comparing cruel remarks by children and calling it violence on comparison with somebody getting kicked, somebody getting their crutches kicked, then there's something very wrong with the society that does that.
Before I come back out, can I just ask, hopefully I'm going to summarise your question a little bit. Because it's something that I sometimes say to people, and I get the reply that I'm going to ask you to answer, is that sometimes taking on the label of disability, of psychiatric illness, psychiatric, all these classifications, is used as a tool to get resources. So for example, I've got a colleague who got his daughter got diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. And I remember having a conversation with him. I says, I thought you didn't believe all these diagnoses. And they said, I don't. But it was the only way that we could gain access to resources. Now, what is there anything wrong with that in and of itself? It's my question to the panel. Cheers, privilege.
I think it's a very complicated issue. My son has a label. In fact, Dennis asked me just before we started, what was his label? And I chose not to answer because what happens is if I tell you his label, you will have a particular image of what that impairment is. You will think that you know something about him that may or may not apply. And what I really want people to do is to ask me about him. If I had another 60-year-old child, you know, what does he like to do? In fact, if I told you what he liked to do, I think you might work out what he's been labelled with, because people kind of do. And I'm in this situation where I sometimes interact with that label in terms of access in social care, because it's a passport. And I think the feminist philosopher Judith Butler talked about using and refusing a label. So that's how I try to make sense of it. But it is actually very difficult not to buy into those sorts of powerful discourses about your child and to see them first and foremost as a child. And it's difficult for me as his mother, and it's even more difficult for the people that we interact with in services and profession.
Yeah, the access to resources thing, absolutely. I was at an autism conference a couple of months ago, and
this came up. Nobody actually questioned it or objected to it. There were academics in the audience, there were parents, there were people with autism. But this notion was kind of raised as we should not narrow the scope of autism or try and come up with a definition that better describes those who are on the spectrum. The argument was we need a wider definition still, but we need a wider notion of who is autistic because we need to be able to access resources, which is kind of a back-to-front way of doing things that you need. I know the medical model isn't very popular in disability circles, but surely there's something to be said for having a medical kind of notion of what autism is. And that should be the driving factor, not the need to access resources. Having said that, the fact that the accessing resources is a problem suggests that not enough resources are available. It may also suggest the opposite, of course. It may suggest that perhaps there are people who are describing themselves as disabled who aren't in any reasonable sense disabled. That's a debate that can go either way. I do think that there's certainly a situation beyond disability where people are encouraged to adopt what the sociologists call a sick role, or they're encouraged to see themselves as victims. And I think that's a major problem, and that has a trajectory of its own that drives people to describe themselves in that way. If you do any survey, I think the scope survey that Dennis mentioned, I think people were asked, would their experience of hate crime and prejudice has got worse, and everyone said yes. But if you ask people, has crime gone up? Everyone will say yes. Has anything got worse? Usually the answer is yes, because that's just the nature of where we are at the moment in society. There is this kind of a social pessimism out there that every social problem is getting worse and everybody's life experience is an unhappy one. So I think we have to stand back from these kind of subjective accounts and look historically at what's changed and what hasn't changed and start from there.
I think that on that thing of funding, I mean, I worked in the addiction and alcohol voluntary work there. One of the tendencies in there is when it started out in Liverpool, probably about, I think it was about 8 years ago, one of the rehabilitation centres there in Liverpool is now actually massive. In fact, I think it just takes over virtually all of the northwest now. But their whole thing was when they were setting up to get funding, they would have to emphasise not the person's addiction or the alcoholism, but the problems that got them there. And it was basically an exercise in inventing mental illness. You had all these tags which you just threw onto people because it was just easy to see them act like that. And that's how they got their funding. I think, if you need the funding, then you have to jump through the hoops. But really, it's a bad system that actually demands that. But again, it's no different really from Arts Council funding, as we talked about previously. You have to jump through hoops, say you're catering for certain minority groups, disabilities and such like. It's part and parcel of the thing that we have.
Thanks. Back out, there's a few hands up. I'll go from the back. So, from the back, yeah?
Thank you. I kind of have concerns that we've actually dwelled on the concept of Paralympics, and some people are comfortable to find accommodation for it, whereas I'm thinking that the whole idea of Paralympics should not, there shouldn't be any Paralympics, because for me it serves to stigmatize people even more and to segregate people even more. The timing of it as well, it's almost like it's just come after the Olympics. It's almost like the leftover of the Olympics. Able people have come and had it the center stage, then the disabled people are clearing up and things like that. I can use analogy of learning disability, the history and progress of it, when people were not recognized at all, up to when there was massive segregation and integration of coming to inclusion. Olympics, Paralympics, we are actually at that stage of segregation. Able people have Olympics, disabled people have the Paralympics. So for me, the whole idea about having it in the first place, it shouldn't be there. We should move faster to having everyone having the same Olympics. Whatever, however it can happen, I don't know, but it should happen that way.
Thank you. Is there someone behind you, Jenny?
I wanted to come back to something Dave said earlier about how far public attitudes have changed to disability. I think most people would agree that's true, but it has got a lot better. People generally think about disability in a way in which they didn't maybe say 30 years ago. But to say that there's no longer any shame on disabled people, I don't think that's right. There's not. We don't have disabled people in the media or in the focus of the world in the same way able-bodied people are. And I think that there's still a lot of evidence that would point to the fact that people are shamed and hidden away, and a lot of that's because of a lack of understanding. And the reason campaigners go on about this, and they sometimes cast disabled people as victims, which I can understand why people would think is a bad idea, and you should just look on the positive face of it, but there's only so far that will take you if you're the victim of crime or abuse. And the fact that the general public still doesn't acknowledge that, doesn't realise entirely what disabled people do go through on a day-to-day basis, and it just reiterates how far away we are from equality.
So we've come a long way, but nowhere near far enough. Yeah. So you're saying that, Jenny?
I've just got a few points to make. First of all, I saw something in the Daily Mail about if Mo Farah had gone into a pub in the week after he'd won the 5,000 metres, I can't remember exactly, everybody would have bought him a drink, because they'd have welcomed him as a migrant, in the Daily Mail. Now, only a few weeks later, we're already back to castigating migrants for coming over here and stealing our benefits. So that's not a great legacy in terms of the Daily Mail. I've got a friend who was lucky enough to go to the Olympics with her children. She said, it was so happy, everybody was happy, singing on the tube, the policemen were letting the children try their hats on. She went back 2 weeks later, in between the events, and it was back to the same old miserable London kind of scene with the policemen acting very officious. So I'm not sure. I don't think that society's attitudes will change as a result of these Paralympics. I totally agree with what you're saying. And actually, I saw a tweet about why was the flame handed over to Rio before the Paralympics. And I was shocked. It was the first time I'd really thought about it, but I thought, imagine if we had a men's Olympics followed by the women's Olympics, or a white Olympics followed by a non-white Olympics. We'd all be shocked. Why aren't we shocked? Or why aren't we angry at the fact that they were separated? Why weren't they integrated? And I think your point, Dennis, about we need to separate children from adults in terms of cruelty. My son's 6. He's really, I feel, far more accepting of disability than my 68-year-old father, who still uses the word handicap and other kind of words, because that was his generation. So I don't think you should separate it, because I think the parents and the parenting is really influential on the children's attitudes. And so, yeah, you have to look at the two together.
That's fine, that's absolutely fine. Carry on for a few minutes. Did you have your hand up there? Anyone else? And I'll bring them.
I was just going to say about the reduction of what's classed as normal and the widening of disability. Could that be to do with the materialistic world we now live in, and the celebrity culture that we've got, that everybody's striving for perfection? And to have somebody with a disability or an impairment that doesn't fit in with that, within that small criteria, and that therefore really should be looking for inclusion more and more and more to make acceptance, to get people to accept that that is part of the norm, and that it's acceptable to be a little bit different.
Before I bring the speakers in, I just think Jenny made a good point. We're thinking, give an example though, of maybe how this sort of, when you fall into the trap of having to emphasise vulnerability and sort of victimhood, that it could be problematic. It's not in relation to disability, but you remember about immigration and sort of migration. Now, I can remember when campaigners would argue that many people should be allowed to come into the country as a right. That should be free movement of people around the world.
Today, as that argument's been lost, the only way that campaigners can argue for someone to be allowed to stay in the country, an asylum seeker, is on the basis of their victimhood. Show us your scars, either physical or mental. It's the only way. Now, you can see in a one-off situation how, if you're about to be kicked out of the country, that is actually, you'll do anything you can to try and stay in. But as a wider tactic, it's a really sad indicator of the current climate, if you ask me. And I suppose the more you do it individually, the worse that climate can get.
But on that point, sorry to come in, it's the same as well about the heroes, the superheroes of the Paralympics. Mm-hmm. When I was supporting an asylum seeker to stay, it was, tell us your horrible stories, but as well, please can you tell us how you've overcome tragedy, how you've become a super asylum seeker, if you like. And actually she was saying, but I haven't done anything good, because I've just been surviving. Oh, do you know what I mean? So it's the same kind of narrative.
So, over to you.
Can I come back to the victimhood, because that came up a few times. I think you can't talk about the victimizer without talking about the victim. And I think we should be talking more about the person who does the victimizing than we are talking about the victim. And going back to my personal experience, if we go back to that bullying experience and the response from the school, the response from the school was to offer my son sort of toilet skills training so that he could defend himself better. What I asked for was disability equality training for the other young people involved. What I want to understand is what's going on in their heads. So in disability studies from North America, we have this notion of normalcy. So we're looking at normalcy, looking at the abled, we talk about ableism. So what are what's going on in their heads? Let's start looking at disabled people and start looking back and saying, what's the situation that's producing these kinds of acts of violence? So I think when I talk about the victims, I equally want to focus on the victimisers. And particularly in relation to people with learning difficulties, I want to talk about potential and I want to talk about aspiration, because it's extremely difficult to get people who think in those medical model labelling ways about people with learning difficulties. It's extremely difficult to get them to do that. They're trying always to move people with learning difficulties towards the norm, or as close as the norm as we can get. So the Paralympians, and you've talked about people with physical disabilities, I think, almost exclusively when you've talked about the Paralympics, they have somehow, by overachieving, been able to expand the category of norm. They've got into the category of norm, but we've left out all the other people. And in a way, we want to, going back to what you were talking about, striving for perfection. Leonard Davis, who's a North American disability scholar, says that we used to talk about the ideal, and no one can achieve the ideal. Now the ideal is Victoria Beckham. No one can be that fit or that miserable. You know, it used to be a Greek god type thing. But we have a sense now that, well, we could be Victoria Beckham if I, you know, starve myself and look miserable enough and I have enough money. But actually, that's a new notion that we can achieve it. We used to think we couldn't, and we were all in some way lacking. But now we have this undefined category of normal that we're all supposed to fit into. So if we could just accept diversity.
Well, it's publicised a lot more now. We've got so many celebrity culture with every magazine, so it's sort of perpetuating this perfect world that we all want to live in.
Yeah.
Or that they say we all want to live in. So you're up against the images, aren't you, all the time?
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder actually what the problem is with that. What's wrong with aiming for perfection? What's wrong with perfect images? It's a question which will always move. But I don't see anything wrong with celebrities, if you have beautiful celebrities, whether male or female, aspiring to that. Whether you reach it or not, it's another thing, but it's a goal to aim for. I think that's another product of this dehumanising factor, that we don't actually aim high anymore, we aim down.
Just let up, you'll have your opportunity in a bit.
But, it does, but I mean, I think that it is, we aim for the lower level and accept the lower level rather than actually aspire to something high and good in human achievement. The point on the Paralympics is quite an interesting one. Why does it happen with the same thing after it comes after the Olympics? That's a historic thing. It was an accident. The original precursor. I wasn't very impressed by the Paralympics. I'm not impressed by that at all because it's not an even. It's not an even thing between even sportsmen. It's or the people that really inspired me in the Paralympics are the blokes and the women that you didn't hear about. The ones that created all those prosthetics. The ones that designed them. And such like, that to me is fantastic. That's inspiration. But it creates an uneven playing field because prosthetics are, of course, designed to the individual and what they're doing in the world rather than. So, therefore, you don't have two equal able body, you don't have a level playing field as you do in the Olympics. Ironically, the precursor to the Paralympics was in 1949. It was the wheelchair amputee games, and it was amputees and people who were in wheelchairs as a result of the war. And that actually was a level playing field. And it's rather ironic that we've actually gone from the fairness of a level playing field in 1949 to it's basically the unfairness of what you have now in the Paralympics. I don't think the two things are the same. The Olympics and the Paralympics are not the same. You can't. You know, a Paralympian may be able to run much faster than an able-bodied person on the prosthetics or whatever they have, but that's not down to them solely. That's down to the prosthetics and the design, and therein lies the difference.
Hold on, Dave, do you want to come in, and then I'll throw it back open.
Yeah, on the Paralympics, I'm no expert. In fact, I obviously swatted up a little bit on the Paralympics before doing this session and made a point of going and reading around the issue. And I was kind of more enthusiastic than I expected to be honest, about the Paralympics. And as I understand it, learning disabled paraathletes, is that what they're called? They were actually took part in this Olympics, Paralympics, but they hadn't taken part in the last few. So there was a reintroduction of people with learning disabilities, which is a good thing. I don't believe that they are stigmatising. And I do think that people genuinely kind of were celebrating what those athletes were doing on the track and elsewhere. They weren't seeing them as, you know, they weren't kind of focusing on the backstory and saying, well done, haven't you done well? It was a much more kind of genuine response, I think. So I'm quite optimistic. And I think that it's interesting that we had this debate about, you know, should Pistorius have taken part in the Olympics? What about all these different confusing categories? It's a problem, but it suggests that, you know, this notion of who is and who isn't disabled is shifting all the time because of advances in technology, because of new training regimes, presumably, and, you know, and that's a good thing. So I was pleased about that, and I'm glad that the Paralympics aren't as PC as I assume they would be. and that they, you know, you can't. I think athletes aren't PC people. Actually, they're all about perfectibility. They're all about performance and, you know, doing that bit better each time, whether they're taking part in the Olympics or the Paralympics. So that's a great thing. On this point about disabled people still being shamed and hidden away, I'm sure there are instances that, and we've heard about some where people with disabilities are mistreated. The argument I'm making is that the climate that we have around disability is so censorious and so obsessed with the language we use. Like, you know, I've been using the term learning disability, and I presume that everyone's probably regarding that as not the term to use. You know, do you call people with disabilities or disabled people? There's a whole discussion about this whole about language, which is very inhibiting. If you have a more open discussion and people feel they can say what they think, or what they feel, and actually, you know, start to understand more, then you can start addressing these issues where there may be problems. I think you have to have that kind of in that climate first before you're able to address any problems that do exist. And finally, this Mo Farah thing. I think that was interesting because when Mo Farah won his golds, I was looking on social media, on Facebook and Twitter, and there was this immediate reaction of, I bet the Daily Mail don't like this. And, you know, these kind of dummy Daily Mail kind of front pages of Mo Farah there, and this notion that we still can't accept a migrant winning this great sporting medal. But that kind of presumed the worst for everybody, which I don't think is true, in the same way that we were all presumed to be prejudiced against people with disabilities. I think this notion that we're divided into victims and bigots, which seems to be the kind of disabled campaigner's viewpoint, is completely patronising for everybody involved.
I'd just like to point out that I had £100 on Mo Farah to win the 10,000 metres. So I was cheering him. So we'll come back out, because there was a couple of you sort of so eager to speak, you just wanted to interrupt the speakers. But it'd be interesting, because we've looked at the Paralympics has come up, so obviously sort of quite a bit, and sort of hate crime. And I just wonder, maybe leading on from what David said, what do people think about what's the solution to, if there are some of these attitudes there, thinking around terms like the censorious nature of we have today, what do we do with Frankie Boyle and Ricky Gervais? Should they be banned from saying such things? It's something I'd like to sort of throw out to cover that in the last remaining bits of the session. But feel free to come in on anything.
I think if you were to ban them, it's almost like saying that they are victims, disabled people are victims and they can't be but a joke. Not that I agree at all with what was said, but no, I wouldn't be happy to see them banned for that either. In a way, it's almost inclusive, isn't it?
Neil?
I have two things. One is a comment and the other a question. First, a comment. I've got these echo chambers going on in my head. A lot of what I'm hearing in the panel sounds like the kinds of debates that I'm much more familiar with from the 90s into the noughties, and indeed that continue to happen around sexual orientation rights. And it strikes me how most of the analysis, particular kinds of analysis, always focuses on what they want and those people who are trying to campaign for rights, for a decent way of being in the world, how those are getting knocked by several of the views on the panel. And that just, I suppose it links for me a bit with what Catherine was saying about focusing on the victimisers, and I think there is a violence in language, and it's not just language that happens in the street when people see or don't see somebody who's disabled, but also the ways in which we frame the whole discourse around disabled and disability. And I guess that comment links to my question, which is about in what ways do the views expressed on the panel tonight reflect what I see, and I know that this might just be about me, but what I see is an incredibly conservative backlash to what just seems so eminently sensibly a humanist, moral, obvious thing that should be making us cry about. Those of us who are able-bodied, or who at least appear able-bodied. So that's my question.
Good question.
I think this is a response to the chair asking about what should we do about the jokers. I think Catherine's emphasis on normalcy is something that we really do need to focus on in terms of what orientation are we taking to normalcy? Is our, when we talk about disability, say as a managerial category, a way of accessing resources, are we sustaining a conception of normalcy as good, just, right, just the way it should be, should remain the same? Or are we, as we use disability as a managerial category, or as an artistic category, or as an experiential category, are we starting to trouble what normal looks like? Or what are we expanding the category, shrink? Are we preserving it, or are we questioning it? And it seems like much of the discussion could go to sort of a split between normalcy as it is okay, and we should enhance it, protect it, and let it be. Or normalcy has led to discrimination, death, exclusion, oppression, and we should find ways to collectively question what it means to participate in holding up normalcy. So I really liked your, I really think our relationship to normalcy is something we could continue to question.
Thank you.
And so the jokers,
yes.
Some of the jokers, I think our job would be to say, did this joke or this reference, did it just sustain things as they are? Or did this joke or did this reference, did it make me rethink my relationship to embodiment or disability or my neighbor?
I suppose my question, the way I was posing it was, is there a difference between challenging what someone says, which I think you could argue that we have a sort of moral sort of duty to do for things, but is that different from saying they shouldn't say it or they can't say it? That's the sort of difference I was looking at there. Come to you now, Simon.
Just on Neil's point about the violence in language and it just being so obvious. Well, it's not obvious to me. For example, I do not want to be blind. And if I was blind and there was an operation to have that would make me sighted again, I would want that operation. Now, am I dissing disabled people or people who are blind by doing that? I don't think so. And I don't think there is an inherent violence that is a hate crime that leads to real violence against blind people embedded in that. It's not a normal activity, the language leading to violence. And I think when people use the violence of language, there's a real profound problem in terms of using language, that it becomes a supercharged activity that leads to a censorious climate. Also, it actually diminishes and degrades the real problem of violence by equating it to words spoken. And I think some of the examples that people use in terms of trying to substantiate a claim about a widespread or growing problem of hate crimes and violence against disabled people in societies. You use one example of your son being bullied in a toilet. Exactly the same happened to me when I was a kid by kids who were a bit bigger and a bit older. Now you might say that's ageism against young people, but it's not. It's a nasty way that we become civilised. We are not civilised as kids. We are brutal animals learning and becoming socialised. And so to start kind of equating what goes on in a school toilet with what's happening in society, or to extend from that situation into wider society, for me is profoundly unhelpful. Concentrate on what's happening in larger, wider adult society, rather than bog washing as it was known when I was a kid.
There's someone at the back there, and then chap in the corner.
It's just to go back to the point the question you raised, whether we should ban this kind of people in the society, or whether we should ban them saying things like that. I'll go back to ancient aristocratic milieus where there used to be fools or jokers who would entertain the kings, and they almost had a license to joke and point out the follies of the kings and queens, whereas no other people could do it. So this served that vital role of unveiling certain things, and if we come back to our current society, we can see these kind of people as people who have sold the individuality to present as those kind of fools who are assuming those kind of licenses to present these different views about or to trigger discussions about this kind of thing. So I'll
favour
a situation where we have this kind of comments on
the
Okay, thank you.
Corner? Yeah, I was just going to reply to Simon in the first place, because I actually take the opposite view. So my response is very much in sympathy with Catherine's view in terms of that particular example. I'm not quite sure which society you're living in, Simon, because there are examples, and I could provide you with a lot of that kind of bullying behaviour that does go on. And one of the problems we've got about talking about what are these categories is that understanding the group and how any group, whether we're talking about disabled or whether we're talking about any other definition of social grouping, can also exclude certain people. It's how that dynamics work, which is also very interesting now that we are moving on. There has been a lot of improvement in society in general, but there is still an awful lot of work to do in those things. That's a major thing. The other point, going back to some of the dialogue earlier on, is to think about we talked about the shifting categories and how people have to fit into categories in order to obtain benefits, etc. I mean, a lot of this is, I think, conditioned by simply economic conditions, and they are distorting a lot of the ways that we're thinking about disability. I'll just make those two points.
Okay, thank you. Any others? And then
on the violence of language or lack thereof, there are words for disabilities, particularly my personal disability, I have epilepsy, that I use when I'm in a room with other people who are disabled, but I will not say it. Because I just can't bring myself to, because they can be so violent in a way that would make you feel afraid for your personal safety and stress. The other thing I'd like to say is that some children are cruel, but they learn it. I didn't instinctively become cruel to my cousin, who has a serious learning disability, heart collection or something, when I had dinner with him when I was a little child. And I somehow managed to, with my friend, get her in her wheelchair on and off those tiny little bus with the tiny business when I was 14. And I managed not to be abusive to her. I don't think children have to be like that. I think they learned. And I also don't think that bullying stops suddenly when you turn inventive age 16, 18, 21, 31. In fact, I stopped using my disabled bus pass because I had so many bus drivers who wouldn't let me on because I didn't look disabled.
Okay, is there any further points before I bring the panel in for their closing comments? Anyone else?
Just wanted to say one thing about Seth. It's when you described you had a similar experience to Patrick Sir. The point that you were making, I think, that there's something obviously wrong here, is that was an experience I assume you wish hadn't happened, that everyone here would wish hadn't happened to anyone. It doesn't make it any less bad because it happens to any people as well. It's a problem that we as a society should deal with.
So good job there's not a crucifix here or something. I'm going to bring the speakers in reverse order so you can address any of the final questions and comments, and then your concluding remarks, please.
On the violence of language, when I was 21, I was involved in an Irish movement. And I'm Irish myself. And I remember a couple of coppers on this line, or protest line, and they were like really giving us some stick and calling me a Paddy Bastard and worked. And I did actually get arrested a couple of weeks later on the same thing, where I was taken into a cell and they broke two of my ribs. I think the violence that they meted out to me, which left me with two broken ribs, caused a little bit more problems than being called a Paddy Bastard. So I don't go along with this sort of thing about language. One of the things we're quite capable of getting over it. I think the thing about bullying is a real problem. And it's a problem both for all sections. The problem with this idea of bullying is that it tries to turn what is individual behaviour into a social phenomenon. When in the 70s, for example, the women's movement looked at the original women's movement looked at rape as violence against women, which is what they did. I mean, that was the dominant thing. It wasn't personalised. They were making a statement about power, sort of thing. And I think if we talk about violence against disabled people, those disabled people weren't around, the perpetrators of that violence, would they just take it out on someone else? The point I'm making is that it's a very individual thing, which you're trying to make out to be some sort of social phenomenon, which is nothing of the sort. And I think that is a problem. But I mean, on the whole, I think tonight we've actually—it is a very—the issue of disablement, I think, is a massive issue because it says a lot about us as humans. And I think the whole thing about able-bodied people being uncomfortable with disabled people is the fact that it's that old philosophical thing: we're faced with our own immortality, and it's the same whenever we see. Whenever we see anything weaker or such like. I don't think that the emphasis on the weakness of disabled people or anybody else is actually going to take us any way forward. My own thinking on what the government are doing at the moment is that, yeah, they'll probably make a few changes and they'll probably make a few concessions. But the whole idea, I think, of what they're doing it's not just a sort of like them being vicious Tories. I think they have—they've accidentally raised some quite important questions in this idea of how we now view disability.
Okay, thanks, Dennis. Catherine.
I just want to return quickly to this question about the segregation of the Paralympics, and I just want to give a point of information, really, because Tanny Gray Thompson, who's the Olympic Paralympian, 11-time gold medal winner, she's really anti amalgamating the two events. And she says that if we do that, no one will watch the Paralympians. So I'm just giving her view from the view of a disabled person talking about them. I'm not sure what to make of that. I lean to what you were saying, but I wanted to give that point of information, really. And then I wanted to go back to this sort of denial of the existence of or the category of disability hate crime. And to say that I think that says something we should be asking, what does that say about the ables, that they need to deny the existence of hate crime against disabled people? And I want to remind us of the case of Fiona Pilkington, who was a woman who was bullied for years and years and years, and her experiences of violence, name-calling and so on, were denied, were not taken seriously by police, and she killed herself and her child. So that's where denial of disability hate crime ends.
Okay, thank you, Catherine. Finally, Dave.
We've talked a little bit about the inflation of the category of disability and how that may or may not be a problem. Somebody raised the issue of bullying, and I think a few people have mentioned bullying, and the interesting thing about that is that that's another category that we tend to inflate and we tend to apply to all sorts of very different situations, and we regard ourselves as adults as being bullies or being bullied, which is a very new development, in the workplace, for instance, which we never would have done in the past. We had a very specific notion of what bullying meant. It meant something that happened in the playground or in the toilets. It wasn't something that happened in adult society. And one of the ways in which it's been expanded is this notion of exclusion, that by not being somebody's friend or by not including them, that in itself is bullying. So Taking that kind of as my starting point, I'd argue that perhaps what we should have is a very different view of the way we should talk about disability and how we should approach the notion of offence taking. I think, you know, having somebody said we should have a more inclusive notion of the way we talk about, you know, Frankie Boyle or Ricky Gervais or whoever it might be. Like, if we have something inclusive offence taking, you know, why should we leave out one group and from this notion that we can all be open and we can all make jokes, we're all kind of robust enough to deal with this sort of thing. I think comedy isn't something which is genteel; it tends to be cruel. And that's kind of just, you know, we can't change that. However much we don't like the language, we can't change that kind of basic kind of dynamic. So I think, you know, perhaps we need to kind of become more robust. Identity politics, which we haven't talked about really, is a big problem, I think, particularly within the disability rights movement. So for those of us who actually regard developments such as prosthetic legs or cochlear implants or various other kind of improvements in the way we tackle certain issues around disability as a good thing, are often faced with the reaction that this is kind of problematic, that it's a challenge to this notion that disability is constitutive of a culture. So I think we kind of often the focus on language and on identity around disability kind of gets in the way of actually looking at how we might actually improve people's lives and how people with disabilities might be able to approach what we call normal. And I think that's another category we need to perhaps defend. The use of the word normal is not necessarily a problem in the same way that the use of the word perfection isn't a bad thing. I think the definition of normal has itself changed. And again, we've seen that in the Paralympics. That the very notion that Paralympians could possibly compete alongside Olympians is in itself a challenge to this notion that people with disabilities aren't able to see themselves in the same light as somebody who's able-bodied. So I think that we need to get beyond a lot of the themes that have held back sensible discussion about disability and start being much more frank and less wary about taking offence, and also have a view of people with disabilities which is much more respectful and much more acknowledging that everybody actually wants to be able to actually have a very kind of honest discussion about these kinds of issues.
Thank you. Can you give our speakers a round of applause?